talk that matters. Germ Warfare and Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I don't know. I think Alex Jones was onto something. I mean, if you listen to my conversation with James Fetzer, he's done pretty serious investigations into Sandy Hook. I think Patrick is correct. It's absolutely insane to fine Alex Jones for speech, for words, even if he's wrong. But I have my doubts about the official story, as I think we all should. When it comes to any official narrative, have we not learned in the last 2.5 years that official narratives are almost always fabricated? Always. Actually, not almost, always. Anyway, email me, germwarfare@tntradio.live. Anything you want, comment, feedback, questions. If you email me during the show and it's relevant, I'll read it out to my guest, who is at the moment Thierry Bourdais. He's going to be joining me in a moment. Also, thank you to everybody who has been sending me emails. I really do appreciate all the feedback. I love that that you're enjoying the show, the guests. You know, it's pretty pointless having a radio show if nobody listens. And speaking into the void sucks. So getting your feedback is always welcome. Do download the app, the TNT app. It's in the Apple and Google store. This just simply means that you can listen to every show as if it were a podcast. So you can do it after the fact. And listen, I strongly recommend you listen to my conversation this week with Whitney Webb. Oh my goodness me, it was off the hook. She spoke about her new book coming out about Jeffrey Epstein. It is next level. Whitney is probably the best investigative journalist in the world. Her book is so big that she's split it into two volumes. I have bought both. They are on their way. I think that there's an entire container just for my two books because she has so much information and citations in those books. Okay, tell you what, let's get to my guest. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas on TNT Radio.
News you need to start your day.
Updated first thing in the morning.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
My friend, Thierry Bourdais. Thank you.
Hello, Germ. How are you?
Yes, I am fantastic now that you're here. I'm great now that you're here. It's a Friday, and I believe that you're going to be a dad again.
First time in my life, but yeah, my wife.
Oh, first time. Why did I?
Maybe
sorry,
because,
I got that wrong.
I've got so many intellectual children, Germ. All my books also are my children.
And also probably because you're a staunch supporter like I am of the family, which leads one to believe that you already have a family. But I am so glad, Thierry, yeah, that you're going to be a dad. This is very, very exciting. Congratulations. How are you feeling?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm feeling very excited, a little bit nervous as well. My wife is doing terrific. I mean, she's just been in an excellent health and great spirits. So yeah, it's going to be a very exciting weekend.
And I'm guessing exhausting.
Probably. Everybody tells me that, yeah.
Listen, I have to ask you, Thierry, do you know who the father is?
Well, I've got some, I've got a few clues.
Oh my goodness me, what a week it has been on so many fronts. You had the most bizarre experience in Parliament. Tell me about that.
So just like a few other parliamentary democracies in Western world, we have our opening ceremony every year in September, and you get what is in Britain, the King in Parliament. We have a similar ritual in the Netherlands where our King gives an opening speech, not in Parliament, but in a beautiful hall next to Parliament. And then all members of Parliament, or the leaders of the several parties, can give their general thoughts about the political situation in the country. And it's a good tradition that all the members of the cabinet, the government, sit in and listen to what the several parties have to say. And after that, of course, the normal discussions start on all the specific policy areas. But this is the opening moment where you say your general thoughts. And during my speech, which was a couple of days ago on Wednesday, the members of the government, the cabinet, walked out of parliament. And that was precisely after I had pointed out that our deputy prime minister, the minister of finance, a lady called Sigrid Kaag, who has worked for the United Nations, who is a frequent guest at the World Economic Forum, who is a typical exponent of the globalist elite. I had pointed out that she had gone to St. Anthony College in Oxford, which is well known as the spy college, because it's precisely where cultural Marxists were recruited for top positions in governments, especially the British government, but also international positions, NGOs, and so on. And therefore, that St. Anthony's, in my view, was the perfect example of the blend that we have seen throughout the 80s and 90s of cultural Marxists on the one hand and big government and big businesses on the other, which explains, in my view, the globalist takeover and the great reset which we're witnessing today. So the reason that I said it was very relevant for explaining how the world has come to the point where it is now, where we have all these mega trends, these global mega trends from COVID policies, which were almost identical throughout the Western world, mass immigration, which is supported by governments throughout the Western world, climate policies, the sustainable development goals, European unification, the war in Ukraine and NATO, all these major policy areas, all of the major players of the mainstream political parties, journalism, and so on, big business, are on the same line. They have the same positions there. And that can only be explained by talking about ideas. They share the same ideas. Where did those ideas come from? They came from universities, such as St. Anthony College, Oxford, which happens to be the place where one of our members of the cabinet went to. So I think it was an entirely relevant and legitimate point to make. But of course, these people don't like to be named and pointed out, and the press immediately took their side and said that I had been spreading conspiracy theories, as they always do, and they didn't give me the chance to respond. They took the right to speak from me, and I was not allowed to utter a single word in parliament anymore for the rest of the day.
So you were over the target.
And indeed, this is unprecedented. This has not happened before in the entire history of our parliament.
Yeah, which means that you were over the target.
I think I hit bullseye. I think I pointed out precisely the thing that they do not like being pointed out, which is that the policies that they're implementing do not originate from their brilliant individual thoughts and ideas, but they are exponents themselves of ideas which are nurtured and created elsewhere, and they are simply the henchmen. They are the lackeys. They are the implementers, the operators of something much larger that's going on in the world.
I forgot that the Netherlands has a king.
Yeah, I forget it all the time too.
Is he just ceremonial, or does he have any kind of clout?
I think he has quite a lot of power, actually. I think the royal family is quite unfortunately quite influential in our country and also abroad. I think in general royalty is more influential than people know and people would like. On the other hand, I also think that they are ready basically to defend almost any policy as long as they are allowed to stay in power. So I don't think that ideas originate with them. I think it's just, if you look at the royal families across the Western world, as far as I know the Dutch situation best, of course, but I think it's a general trend. If you look at their positions, you will see the voice of the globalist elites. This is why Harry and Meghan are the way they are. This is why Maxima, the Queen of the Netherlands, when she went to the US, picked a fight with a Texas governor on abortion and then went on to San Francisco to visit, together with Nancy Pelosi, the LGBTQI neighborhood. I think we can use it to understand where the globalist elites are, or where they're at.
No conversation with you is complete until we tap into some of the important issues. And since you're going to be a father, I want to just chat to you, if you don't mind, a little bit about why traditional family values matter. Because in my mind, civilization does not happen without a traditional family.
My first reflex is to say that civilization happens when people build communities. And there is no community without the ultimate nucleus of a community, which is a family. So my instinctive response would be to say, this is the basis of everything that is not manageable. And the problem that we face, the anti-civilizational force, is and has always been the idea that we can reshape life according to our own desires. It's the Gnostic fallacy. It's the alchemist's fallacy. It's the attempt to control life and to recreate it. And that's essentially the conflict between Lucifer and God, isn't it? That's the ultimate distinction between good and evil. Accepting natural law, if you will, or believing that it's ultimately part of our own possibility of creation, and therefore hubris, right? So in my view, the family is the ultimate antidote to hubris. It's the basic community, the starting point for everything that allows us to understand ourselves as being part of something greater than ourselves.
I bring that up only because there is a very obvious agenda that's happening in the West that is basically to attack the family unit and to break it apart and to redefine it.
Yeah, that's true. And there are several elements in this, but one trend that also weakens the family is the obsession with monogamy. And that's an interesting thing, I think, that not a lot of conservatives have talked about. But if you desire to protect the family, you must be easy on infidelity.
Which, of course, is something that you shouldn't be.
What do you mean?
I'm trying to follow your train of thought. You're saying that we mustn't be easy on.
No, we should be conservatives. I think if you want to protect the family, you should not judge infidelity too much.
Oh right, yes. I'm following you.
So monogamy is something that is almost impossible for people to achieve, and so there are many trends, and there are obvious trends that weaken the family, like divorce laws, like weakening of the inheritance taxation on inheritance, the propagation of hedonistic lifestyles and so on. But ultimately, there's also another element, which is the Hollywood vision of love, and that's as much, I think, a threat to the family as are these the other postmodernist elements that we all agree on and that are obvious. but and feminism and all of that. But and this is something that I don't think conservatives have talked about a lot, because conservatives tend to be rather prudish and rather shy to talk about these things. But if you are serious about protecting families, I think you have to be serious in admitting that monogamy is not necessarily a part of a healthy family. Even more so, that a healthy family understands that these things are separate or can be separate, or there's a way to deal with them that is grown up, that is civilized, which has been like this for centuries, and it's a new thing. It's an American thing that came to the European world. This absurd prudeness and the obsession with you can't even show a nipple on American television, but on the other hand, everybody is addicted to porn. There's something really conflicting about that. And I mean conflicting. Okay, I mean there's something really. Yeah, go on. Sorry.
No. Just finish your line of thought.
There's something. So this is, on the one hand, we have the sex that's completely disconnected from intimacy and so on. And on the other hand, we have the obsession with monogamy. And I think conservatives need to understand that both are wrong.
Right. Okay. I'll be back with you after this break.
TNT Radio's Omira and Borgeson.
The Queen left her son with huge shoes to fill, and the question now becomes, who is he really? And what kind of player will he be on this current world stage that is so different from the time his mother embarked on her journey as a monarch?
Yeah, you know, Christine, it's going to be very, very interesting to watch this unfold. You know, whatever you think about the future of the monarchy, you have to admit that Elizabeth II handled it with great dignity and grace, I think. I mean, can you argue with that?
I don't want to say anything untoward about the Queen, because she did her job quite well. But, you know, the monarchy itself, for a lot of people, what it represents, how it got to be the monarchy, and so on. That's a problem for a lot of people.
Omira and Borgeson on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Mainstream media censors, smears, and intimidates those telling the truth. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Thierry, let's talk about your new book.
Yes. It's called The COVID Conspiracy, The Globalist Takeover and the Great Reset. And I would love to send to your listeners to give them the option of winning free copies, but it's not ready yet. It's not from the printer yet. I haven't got it yet. So I hope to be able to come back in your show in a couple of weeks, and then we'll do this winning, this option for them to win a copy of the book. It basically, what I tried to do, obviously the whole world was taken by the COVID pandemic and in the grip of fear. But I'm trying to describe how gradually I came to understand that the whole COVID pandemic was in fact a scam that we've been lured into a society of fear, where we accepted vaccinations, we accepted QR codes, we accepted lockdown, social distancing, ridiculous face masks for people and children as young as 2 years old. This is really, it's a case study of how a globalist structure was able to implement across the world the same completely irrational policies, which ultimately led to a massive increase in control over our lives.
I've gone through your book, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's called The COVID Conspiracy, yeah. And it's about how, in the past 2.5 years, a globalist elite conspired to take over our societies through fear, through control measures, through medical injections, QR codes, and ultimately how they aim to install a social credit system modeled after the Chinese system.
We'll come back to your book in a second, but I've received a few comments regarding your monogamy thing, and I just want to go back to that because you are getting a lot of love for saying that. So I'd be very curious for you to expand just a little bit on it, because apparently it's a concept that people, particularly on the right, don't investigate. So I'd like to just hear a little bit more of your thoughts on what you mean by the whole thing.
Is it possible to ask me a more specific question about it, so I know what you'd like me to comment on?
All right. So let me give you a more specific question. You're acting like a politician, Thierry.
I do not take that as a compliment, my friend.
Why is monogamy destructive to families?
Because it's an impossible standard to meet. There is hardly any relationship which lasts for more than, let's say, 5 years, in which there is an actual fulfilling sexual element. Nevertheless, so this is the case for, let's say, 90 to 95% of all heterosexual relationships. I cannot speak for how homosexual relationships are, but I'm guessing that it's the lifespan of the sexual element in that relationship is even shorter. So what happens is that something new happens in the vast majority of relationships, which is intimacy, which is building a house, a family, which is raising children, and there's so many other elements, friendship, and so on and so forth, the accumulation of capital. And these are very important thing which lasts for generations. And the emphasis which was placed on relationships and marriages in the 1960s especially and 70s of the complete unification of two souls, and the ideas that there should be forever the conflation of love and sex and taking care of children and running a household and so on and so forth, was in fact an unattainable ideal, which is why we had all these waves of divorces. And the suppression of that fact of nature, which is that after a couple of years, the sexual fascination usually wanes. The acceptance of that fact, or ignoring that, or denying it, either way, accepting it, I think, can lead the way to much more stable and successful relationships on the one hand, and denying it will lead on either to frustrated relationships, where you see, this is a typical thing, we see men, I'm sure you know the image, men walking like this next to their wife, who has short hair and doesn't look attractive anymore at all. And it's just, they look like they're a dead couple. You see that a lot. And on the other hand, marriages breaking up for the wrong reasons, for sex, for something which is an inescapable part of human life, and especially of masculine life, which makes basically everybody unhappy. The woman who has been taught to become very angry when a man is with someone else through feminism and other and other ideological elements that are impregnated in her in their heads. The man who ends up away from his family, probably with a girl that he doesn't want to start a relationship with, but he just wanted to have sex with. Children growing up in separated households, the loss of capital, the inability for the next generation to have one house where the grandparents, or family house where the grandparents are. So it's just, divorce is a tragedy on so many levels when it comes to the preservation of civilization and the passing on of values and traditions and so on. And the reason is our inability to accept that monogamy is not part of human nature. So in my view, the conservative point of view should be marriage is important, long-term relationships are important, keeping a family together is important, but monogamy is not necessarily very important.
I'm really fascinated by this conversation. I know that it wasn't part of our agenda, but I'm going to hold on to it for a few minutes longer, because look at this. I'm getting I'm getting loads of comments coming in. So let me read you something quickly. It's unnatural and an impossible standard through an entire lifetime. The natural order would be for men to have more than one woman in most cases. Some of God's favorite men in the Bible had numerous wives.
Yes, that's true. I agree with that. And not just that, it's also something that we as men should aspire to. We should aspire to remaining attractive our entire lives, even if we do not necessarily feel the inclination to sleep with other women. We should always make sure that we have the option of sleeping with other women, if only because it makes us much more attractive to the girl or the woman that we're with at a certain particular moment of time. Because if you think as a man, she is my only option, if she leaves me, I will be alone for the rest of my life, then she will not admire you. She will not, you know, feel like a woman next to a strong man. So it's important for many reasons not to feel that, you know, once you found the one, then the hunting season is essentially over. No, it's always going to be hunting season, and it should be.
Yes, another comment. The issue is that we live in an instant gratification world, and the children who come from a broken marriage have a huge divorce rate.
Yeah, I think there's... this is, of course, something that is where social science is a bit short on evidence, because it's been... It hasn't been very long since we had the first major divorce waves. So I should like to say that the evidence on this is inconclusive, but my intuition is that these figures are probably right, and that if as a child your deep sense of whole and unity and connection has been broken in such a way, then it's excruciatingly difficult to recreate it within yourself. I think that's, my intuition is that that's true.
But isn't the idea of marriage to actually commit to one person, which is why it's so difficult?
I know that Christians think that. Yeah. And I know that some conservatives say that because it's unnatural, it's a civilizational effort, and you're working on this and that. And I'm not propagating a sort of hedonistic lifestyle where nothing really matters, and it's like, you know, you sleep with this person one day and then the next one another one, and oh, sometimes you're at home and. I'm not saying that, you know. Don't misunderstand my words, but I'm very doubtful about the positive outcome of fighting your nature to the extent that some Christians would like us to. I'm not convinced that this works. I haven't really seen it in my life. I found it I find it very sad usually to see married couples. I find very few couples that are very happy together. And I think it's because of the unrealistic demand of monogamy. That's my diagnosis of what we see. Don't you agree, Jerm, that if you look at a man and a woman raising children, it's the man usually looks like a damp cloth, like an old car that hasn't driven for years, and you just see the gray energy on his face. He's just not having sex, and it's bad for him.
Something inside of me wants to agree with you. I've never had this conversation on any of my shows ever. So while you're talking, I'm thinking. So I haven't calculated my thinking yet. So you and I will have to continue chatting about this, I think, in the coming shows, because it's a very interesting concept. Because I think, Thierry, there is definitely some truth to what you're saying. I mean, human nature is a very difficult force to fight. And it does appear to me, and I'm not trying to make excuses now for, you know, sleeping with other women because I love my wife. Yes.
Yes.
But if I'm being very honest with myself and I think about how men are, I can't speak now on behalf of women. I think they operate differently. But men generally are hunters. And keeping them, you know, caged up does seem to be, like, to me, a bad idea. But I don't know. I have to think about this. So you're going to have to continue talking so I can think some more.
But it's actually a democratic idea. That's what I'm trying to say. So there is a deep connection, I think, between the obsession with monogamy, which destroys man, on the one hand, and all the other terrible things that the globalists have been pushing on us, on the other. So our testosterone levels are artificially going down because of the unrealistic demand of being monogamous. This was never part of Western civ, never. Throughout the 19th centuries and before that, this is an interesting, very interesting thing, actually, if I still have time, and then we can talk about it more later. But one of the most interesting things that I've come to realize recently is that history is written by the higher middle classes. And the typical thing about upper middle classes is, or lower aristocracy, upper middle class, those people, if you read sociology books like Norbert Elias, The Process of Civilization, for example, one of the most famous books about how manners and customs have come to develop, that the interesting thing is that those people, the upper middle classes and the lower aristocracy, have always been most Puritan and strict when it comes to how you behave. So the typical example is that the laborer in the street will say, "I'm going to take a piss." The lower middle class guy will say, "I'm going to the loo." Then the upper middle class guy or lower aristocracy will say, "I'm going to the bathroom." Right? And then the king, the top of the aristocracy, will say, "I'm going to take a piss again." So manners have this shape, you see? So
a diamond.
The lowest bottom are shaped like a pyramid, about two pyramids, up and down. So the lowest part of society has easy manners, and the highest part of society has easy manners. But in the middle, there's a certain strictness. And it's precisely those people who write history books. And that is why we have this fake idea of the Victorian age, where everybody was supposedly entering marriage a virgin, which is nonsense, which never mm-hmm. happened in Western society and before that. People went naked to the bathhouse because they only had one pair of clothes. They slept in the same rooms. It was the typical life of a European throughout the centuries was an easy social life. And we used to have in Europe between 100 and 150
festive days. The average farmer in Europe throughout the centuries worked something between 150 and 100 and, or 200 days per year. So almost half of the year was party. And people partied socially, and they drank, and no doubt they slept with each other. And we have this layer of Puritanism over our history, where we've created this fake idea that for 2,000 years, you know, women were faithful to their husband, and husbands entered marriage a virgin and stayed with them the rest of their lives. And I'm sure there have been people, and there have been generations where this was more common, and then other times and generation where it was slightly less common. But this has not been the general pattern of European history. This has been written in the Victorian age by the upper middle classes or the lower aristocracy, who wanted to project their social ambitions on the rest of society. And then it was reinforced by what I call the Hollywood vision of love. And in a way, perhaps the flower power naivety of it, which oddly also propagated free sex, but at the same time created the unrealistic dream of love forever and everlasting intimacy and so on. But historically, this has never been the general pattern in European life. And it's very important, I think, to realize that, because conservatives they tend to use this as a historical argument. Like, okay, in the past we had better music, we had better cathedrals, we still conquered nations, we had high fertility rates, and so on. I agree with all those points, but I do not believe that they are connected to monogamy. They're connected to many things, but not to monogamy. Mm.
Yes, another comment. Where is it now? Oh, yes. It's important to keep families together, more important than monogamy. I mean, that's very interesting. Yeah. So, in other words, prioritizing the family over the monogamous relationship. Sure.
Absolutely. Very much so. It's a much higher value. And it's typical for feminism, I think, that women have been lured into not being able to make that distinction anymore. So the idea that the woman becomes very, very angry and decides to kick out her husband when at a certain evening he stayed the night with some with a girl or whatever. This is precisely what the globalists want women to do.
Mm. Well, yes, a contrary comment.
Go ahead.
She says, there's too much weight on being happy. What's wrong with struggling? What's wrong with being unhappy? This is a problem with belief that. Argument and debate, which leads to cancel culture and shutting down of debate. In other words, what's wrong with trying to work through those differences?
Well, I love the question. It's definitely, I mean, this is what I think conservatives should be talking about. Mm. And what's the point where struggling becomes counterproductive. I think these are questions, and I totally accept them as legitimate questions. I would say that keeping marriage together itself is already difficult enough, even if you take out the monogamous challenge.
I am fascinated by this conversation, Thierry, and I think you and I are going to have to chat about this some more in coming shows, because we are only down to about 10 minutes left now, but there really isn't much more that we can do in 10 minutes. And I was hoping to talk to you about your book, but you threw me completely off guard with that curveball. And it's been such an interesting thought experiment that I'm going to think about this in the coming days. I can tell you that much.
Maybe just a side note, your listeners would like us to talk a little bit about the developments in Europe with the elections in Italy and how the war in Ukraine is so important for all politicians here. Those are just two suggestions. Is there anything you
would like to add?
I can tell you a little bit. This is interesting. There are, as they say, populist or nationalist parties all over Europe now on the rise. So we have elections in Italy coming up this weekend where there's a right-wing bloc that is probably going to win the elections. And then in Sweden, we had a nationalist win, and in other countries as well. The shocking thing to me is, although I like anti-immigration rhetoric to become more popular, and I like the fact that they're skeptical about the climate change mystique and so on, but the worrying element to me about this is that right-wing in Europe has traditionally been associated with militarism and being pro-NATO, for example, and wanting to show your muscles on the international stage. And the worrying thing about that is, to me, that the current war, and perhaps almost all of the wars of the past decades, were globalist wars intended to increase the grip of the globalists over our lives. And therefore, my fear is that although we might cheer the right-wing win in Europe, it actually means a victory for our very enemies.
Well, I mean, that's the trap, isn't it? To cheer on the side you think is the correct side.
That's the trick they pulled with 9/11, isn't it? Like all the right-wing people, sure. They were like, oh yeah, let's kick the Muslims' ass and let's just go to Afghanistan, let's go to Iraq, boom, 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 and
Libya too. Libya too, and Syria.
Libya, let's just conquer all the countries in the world. but of course, this was a way to get a certain portion of the electorate, of the people, on board with projects which originated from entirely different agendas. And that's what's happening all the time. So, and that's why democracy, the democracies that we have, quote unquote democracies, are such an elusive, ways to make people believe there's actually a choice where there really isn't one. So it's either if you get socialist politicians, you get more climate change policies, you get more immigration. And if you get right-wing politicians, you get more NATO wars and more globalism through that way.
But what's interesting is that what you're talking about fits into one of your three megatrends. I want to say this again. I love your idea of megatrends.
Thank you. Yeah, so the megatrends are the major policy directions that, in my view, all mainstream parties are supporting. So the one is the migrational element. That's perhaps something that might be slowly shifting a little bit now in Europe. But then the other megatrends will, which they subscribe to generally, will mean ultimately more immigration too. So it's just, you can't escape it. Once you have this megatrend, you have the other megatrend as well. So the second megatrend is European unification, which is precisely what the right-wing parties that are supposedly right-wing parties that are now winning are supportive of. And then the climate change mystique, which is something that people both from the mainstream right and the left are sort of agreeing with. And then there's the war in Ukraine, which I see as a war of globalism or globalists against the last vestige of anti-globalism, which is Putin's Russia, and then finally the COVID policy. So these are the mega trends that we see all across the political spectrum, and it's quite disappointing to see that whether the left or the right wins elections. We saw it very clearly in Britain, where Boris Johnson won the election on a Brexit ticket, and we were all cheering, and we were, oh, finally we're going to get Britain as a sovereign nation back. But a couple of months after realizing Brexit, he turned out to be the most internationalist, pro-immigration, pro-climate change measures, pro-COVID measures, and then pro-Ukraine prime minister in the history of Britain. So it seems to be impossible to beat them in the political realm, and that is why I'm trying to build the parallel society with the Forum for Democracy, yes, my party, and also why I talk about culture so much.
Well, I mean, those are two extremely important, I don't know if they're mega trends. I'm just going to say two extremely important concepts, culture and localism.
And parallelism.
These two are or globalism. These are critically important, and they're both, you can't ignore one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the essence, and it's precisely the two things that the mainstream right has neglected. Mm. Right-wing people never talk about culture in the way that you and I are talking about it. They're never thinking seriously about all these concepts, such as sexual relations, such as art, such as architecture. They all think that's for the private realm. We are right-wing politicians, you know, we want lower taxes, blah blah blah. That's how they see themselves, which is extremely superficial, and it's bound to be ineffective. And the other thing, localism or building a parallel society, this is something that no one really has done, because they all say, oh, we're doing it for the nation, we have to change the nation as a whole. Mm-hmm. We do not want the parallel societies of immigrants, for example. Here's another element of the PSYOP that they're putting on us. So they put the right-wing people in the position where they say, we are against multiculturalism, we're against ghettoism, we're against parallel societies of Muslims. So why are you in favor of your own parallel society, right? That's the trap they've created for us.
Which means that we need to redefine, or simply define, and then use those exact concepts to rebuild and to strengthen our own position.
Yeah, I feel that for the first time in modern political history, we are at a point where we really have to start thinking seriously about what we actually believe in. We were just, we on the right, we conservatives, we were basically sleepwalking. We were sleepwalking along the road that had been paved for us by the deep state, by the people in the background. They've simply, after the Second World War, they've defined what the political spectrum would be, and they've created these more or less coherent positions. One position that we call the right, the other position that we call the left, and with the green left, and with the social economic left, and with the conservative right, and the Christian right, and the libertarian right. You know, those are the positions, and if you believe this, then you also believe that, and that, and that. But all those positions are designed not to question the mega trend, the general trend of the destruction of European life, and the coming about of a great reset, and the globalist takeover. This is the world that has been created for us by the secret services, by those who won the Second World War, and now, and obviously in its wake, the Cold War. But now we really have to think for ourselves if we need to create a different path, if we want to reshape the agenda and rethink who our allies really are and who our opponents really are. And that is the creative process that the alt-right in the United States has been trying to engender, and I think what you are trying to create, and I think so many of us, and the interesting thing is, or the thing I like about it, is that for the first time in my political life, I am having conversations the outcome of which is not fixed beforehand. So you and I are now, we're chatting about something like monogamy. We're chatting about this, and we're both like, you know, I don't know the conclusion exactly either, but I can read it. And the same is true for immigration and so on. But we have to stop. I can get that.
Yes.
At the end of the show. We'll talk later.
All right, Thierry Bourdais. I don't have time to do the promos and stuff, but I'll get you on again, and we can do more promos with your book, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you for joining me in the trenches, Thierry Bourdais. And thank you to Luke for fixing the gremlins. I'll be back in the next hour. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas on TNT Radio.